It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your host, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell and Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
Let's talk legal, the right advice at the right time from Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law. Cecil Harvell is with us this morning with a guest. Hi, Cecil.
Good morning, Ben. How are you?
Doing well.
Good. Listen, Ben, it's our pleasure this morning. Wes and I would like to introduce to our listeners Sam Morris. Sam is a new associate lawyer with Harvell and Collins and is comes to the law firm with some interesting experience for the last 2 years. Sam is a local lawyer.
Yeah, we were just comparing notes about school.
You were. Your children, your son and Sam, I think, were in Croatan High School together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Sam is a graduate of Croatan High School and then on to college and law school and now has clerked for 2 years with the North Carolina Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And so, Sam, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. It's great to be here this morning.
Absolutely.
You went to Campbell Law School?
I did. Yeah. Campbell and Raleigh. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, the Raleigh campus.
Yeah, they actually.
That's the law school's there.
They did, yeah. They moved the law school there a few years ago. They had been in the Creek, in Bowie's Creek, North Carolina, out there in Harnett County. But a few years ago, they moved it to Raleigh. And since then, it's kind of exploded as a program just because of the nature of the location, internship opportunities, and all that stuff.
Did you have a chance to clerk while you were in school or intern?
Well, I did, yeah. And when you're in law school, they're generally going to call it an internship, just to be technical. But I worked also for Judge Allison Duncan on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. She's located in Raleigh and traveled with them up to Richmond, Virginia for oral arguments. And I also worked for the United States Attorney's Office and did a stint in the Governor's Office as well. So, yeah, it was a fun, exciting, and extremely stressful 3 years, as law school is and should be.
Yeah, that's right. So I imagine you were interested in watching TV last night.
It was. You know, it's kind of an interesting time to talk about this because I believe we're going to talk a little bit about North Carolina appellate courts and the Supreme Court in particular, but you know, it's funny because throughout the year, many people don't really follow the court system in general, but whenever you have a Supreme Court nominee, at least at the federal level, the news stations all flash the lights, everyone's talking about it, and so last night, I definitely tuned in and saw the president's nomination, and as did probably millions of others. So.
Yeah, and then I'm a big SCOTUS blog fan, so I follow along with that all the time. So, Cecil, this is a great addition to your team.
It really is. Now, Ben, you know, it is interesting, the North Carolina Supreme Court. Some of our listeners it's hard even for we lawyers to particularly understand sometimes what they do. This is not a trial court. This is not a jury trial. This is not where, you know, Mr. Collins goes and argues his case before a jury with judges making rulings as to evidence and things of that nature. The North Carolina Supreme Court and Sam is going to tell us exactly. It is a court that then reviews various cases and makes a decision based on a record, which is known as the Record on Appeal. It does a few other things as well. So let me turn it over to Sam. And Sam, you kind of tell us how the North Carolina, what the structure of the North Carolina Supreme Court happens to be.
Right. So a lot of our listeners are probably pretty familiar with the U.S. Supreme Court.
Right.
And it's a similar concept. You know, federalism amongst the states and the federal government, we kind of mirror each other in some ways, but there are also some unique differences.
They're elected.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, interestingly enough, North Carolina, we've had kind of an interesting history because under our various constitutions, they were elected in different ways. Before 1868, I believe it was the 1868 Constitution, the people didn't elect the justices. It was that they were actually appointed by the General Assembly. And so, but they are now popularly elected in a statewide election. So each runs in a statewide race, everybody from the Chief Justice on down to the newest member of the court, which would be the Associate Justice or an Associate Justice. Every other member of the court is an Associate Justice other than the Chief Justice. And it's a 7-member court, and cases arrive there generally after going first to the Court of Appeals, which is North Carolina's intermediate appellate court. And those justices, when they're reviewing the case, they sit what we call en banc, which means sit together on a panel. And there is normally an appellant and an appellee. The appellant is the one bringing the appeal. and they first present an oral argument there. It's normally about 30 minutes, although the court has the right to extend that time if necessary,
sure,
depending
yeah.
upon the issues.
They're the ones wearing the robes. They get a chance to do that.
Absolutely, absolutely. But generally speaking, they're going to have oral arguments for about 30 minutes, and then the opposing party will have some time to respond to that about mm-hmm. the same time. And they're not making arguments based upon, you know, the trial court reviewed the facts wrong or the jury reviewed the facts wrong or anything like that. As Cecil was mentioning, if you ever have a chance to visit either the Court of Appeals or the North Carolina Supreme Court in Raleigh, you might walk in and you'll notice that there's no jury box, there's mm-hmm. no witness stand,
right.
because there is no new evidence brought at the North Carolina Supreme Court. They are generally reviewing cases for what we call issues of law, not issues of fact,
mm-hmm.
and they're considering whether the lower courts properly interpreted the law and applied it in a way that's consistent with their existing precedent.
Now, getting there to the Supreme Court is the journey.
It is.
Because it does have to go through the appellate court, and it may have to go through a couple of stages of the appellate court.
It is, and it's a complicated journey. And really, we talked about this a little bit before, just amongst everybody at the firm, but when you start planning your appeal, you don't start planning it at the jury or at the initial stages of the appeal at the Court of Appeals.
Mm-hmm.
You have to start planning it at the trial court because of the fact that the appeal process really begins when you first get that ruling that you're going to challenge at the trial court level.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't make the proper objections or preserve that issue for review, it's not going up. But, you know, a lot of our listeners who are familiar with litigation, you can watch Law and Order and see the way a trial works. But nevertheless, after that time period, parties do what's called a notice of appeal. That's ordinarily going to go to the Court of Appeals directly. And they're going to review the case first for erroneous, admission of evidence, for misapplication of the law and that. From there, you then can go to the Supreme Court in basically one of two ways. If one of the judges at the Court of Appeals, in their opinion, files a dissenting opinion, which means that they disagree with the other two judges,
right.
how they resolve the case,
right.
that case can go directly to the Supreme Court. Importantly, though, in that situation, your basis for review is only that judge's dissenting opinion, so you can't make arguments that that judge didn't address.
We've talked about this before, about narrow the funnel. You know, start with a larger funnel and it narrows down, which we started any kind of practice of law, but this is a special kind of funnel. Yes.
Well, it is, and that's a great analogy, Ben. We just, in the law, and particularly at this level, the appellate level, the issues are narrow.
Mm-hmm.
It turns on, just one issue many mm-hmm. times.
It's no surprise witness bursting through the door.
There. Oh, no. Nope. And of course, there are no witnesses mm-hmm. at this point. So absolutely, this is a very narrowly focused issue, very important issue,
mm-hmm.
having significant consequences for all the parties at the table, if you will, and for the case in general, and of course, also to the body of law of North Carolina. I think that this would be a great place. I mean, there's so much to talk about here, and maybe Sam can come back next week if I can pull him away from some work at the office. But this is, but Ben and Sam, you just tell us, this is how law is created. Tell our listeners about that.
Right. So, our listeners are probably pretty familiar with hearing the U.S. Supreme Court issue an opinion about interpreting the Constitution or something like
right.
that.
Right.
But our state courts do that too, in particular our state Supreme Court. And the North Carolina Supreme Court is the last court in the land, essentially, that can review matters of state law.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they interpret a provision, say whether the North Carolina Stand Your Ground statute allows you to stand in a certain place in public, when they've interpreted that statute,
mm-hmm.
they have given meaning to that statute and interpreted it in a way that it can't be reviewed any further. Generally speaking. So point being is that when the Supreme Court is taking a case and reviewing either a statute or the Constitution and the particular record in that case, their interpretation of it is binding, and going forward, any other cases that might fall under a similar factual scenario are going to be controlled by that case, and that's what we call precedent.
Mm-hmm.
You hear people talk about, precedent, or, there's a case, out of such and such a court or something like that, and they say that it has some authority. Well, that's what it has, and it's because of the fact that the court is charged with the duty to interpret the law, and so that's how the court, you know, gives meaning to the law in a lot of respects.
And in the state Supreme Court, nothing goes beyond that unless it applies to federal rights or constitutional rights.
You're absolutely right, Ben, and that's an important point because, you know, the federal government theoretically is a government of limited powers,
mm-hmm.
and so the judges on federal courts also have what we call limited jurisdiction. They can only review certain types of case and controversies that arise under federal law.
Mm-hmm.
North Carolina is not like that. Our state courts have a wide body of law that they can interpret and that they deal with daily. And so the North Carolina Supreme Court, when it rules on an issue of state law, which is far broader than federal law, that is it. That mm-hmm. is it. There is no further appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, generally speaking. And even if the case might implicate federal law, you know, let's say a constitutional provision or something like that, the North Carolina Supreme Court's interpretation of its statute or of its constitution
mm-hmm.
binds the U.S. Supreme Court. So there's no way for them to be reversed essentially on those grounds.
If you're sending something up for appeal or trying to from a district or superior court and you're sending it up to appeal, is it just first by one of the judges on the appeals court? Are they the one that review it first and say, or does the entire court review it?
Well, generally, it's going to be panels of three.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that means is that you have a case that goes up to the Court of Appeals and you're calendared for oral argument. You're going to be presenting your argument before three judges, and those three judges are going to conference right after the case and decide how they want to determine the case, and then they will issue an opinion. So it's normally three judges that are going to be reviewing it.
Just accepting it for an appeal.
I can't speak to the Court of Appeals on that just because of the fact that so many of their cases they have to take. They don't mm-hmm. really have a basis accept it.
Gotcha.
Because normally parties have a direct right of appeal on those on a trial court issues.
Mm-hmm.
For the first instance, you have mm-hmm. a direct right of appeal. North Carolina Supreme Court's very different. Though I said earlier that there is a thing called a notice of appeal from a dissenting opinion at the Court of Appeals, there is the largely discretionary docket of the North Carolina Supreme Court, and you get there through a petition for discretionary review.
Okay.
And I'm not sure if we have time right now to discuss that. I don't know if we need to go to a break or not.
Yeah, we do.
Well, we'll talk about that.
Very familiar with this. He's familiar with radio. That's going to be very helpful in the future, Sam.
Absolutely.
All right, we'll have more to come in a moment here on Coastal Daybreak here on the Talk Station, FM 107 and AM 1240. Hey, welcome back here. Coastal Daybreak here on the Talk Station. Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. And Cecil Harvell is with us. And Cecil, how about reintroducing your new compatriot here?
Absolutely. Again, Ben, Sam Morris is here with us. Sam has completed a 2-year clerkship with the North Carolina Supreme Court, which is about what you do. Isn't it about a 2-year clerkship for most folks, or no?
Well, it depends mm-hmm. on the justice. Each justice mm-hmm. is allocated at least two, a legal staff of two people, new lawyers, generally speaking, and that justice can decide how long they want to keep their staff on. The justice for whom I clerk, Justice Newby, he liked to have a rotating basis with 2-year clerkships. That way you would have someone who would be more senior there, helping the new person learn mm-hmm. what all is going on, because there's a lot to understand what's going on there.
Right.
He had it set up that way. Some justices have 1 year, and some justices have a kind of like a career type clerk model. Mm-hmm. So it really depends on the chambers.
That's interesting.
I've seen Justice Newby in a couple of settings, and he's been a pretty outgoing guy. I was surprised.
He is. You know, it's
you don't think about that with a Supreme Court justice.
No, you don't. But he's a very active member of the court, and he's been charged in a lot of respects with kind of promoting civic education amongst the court. Mm-hmm. So he does a lot of civic engagements, particularly with young people, informing them of what the court does, you know, and all that stuff. So he's very active, and he's kind of one of the faces of the court, and he's also the senior associate justice, which means he has been there the longest outside of everyone else, and he's kind of, you know, next, he's second down in seniority from the chief.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
One of the things to put in context here, and of course, I, again, introducing Sam to listeners who might have just tuned in. Sam, of course, now is full-time a lawyer associate with the law firm here, Harvell and Collins. And listeners might be wondering, well, my goodness, do you guys really do, that kind of work at the Supreme Court? And the answer is absolutely. Mm-hmm. So to put this in context a bit, Ben, as Sam was explaining, this is where our laws are mm-hmm. developed. This becomes what is known as case law in the state of North Carolina. So when Wes and I talk about, you know, a holographic will and what is required for there to be a handwritten will, when we talk about the rights of a spouse, such as the elective share or the right to a year's allowance under the statute, mm-hmm. when we talk about the hierarchy of who is appointed as administrator of an estate, when there is no will, and mm-hmm. we have to find an administrator. As you know, we've discussed on the program, right. the statutes of North Carolina set forth a hierarchy. These statutes are then interpreted by the North Carolina Supreme Court. And so there are cases that then we lawyers read that give us added information as to, you know, what does it mean for there to be two witnesses and a notary? Do they all have to be in the room at some time? Suppose someone's just standing in the doorway.
Right.
You know, the nuances of the law are then located, if you will, in these cases mm-hmm. that Sam has just finished, you know, 2 years of writing these cases. Mm-hmm. That is literally what the law clerks do, is to compose drafts of the case mm-hmm. that then becomes codified in the, I don't know that codified is the right word.
No,
becomes
that's the legislature.
But it becomes part of the
case law.
Case law, absolutely.
Right.
Yep.
And so these cases have to be written. Mm-hmm. They are then indexed in ways that we lawyers know how to find them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they become precedent. Mm-hmm. They become the law that we then use, before the clerk of court, mm-hmm. before the district court judge, before the superior court judge, in arguing our position. We then say, well, judge, in the case of Jones versus right. Morris in the year 1999, the North Carolina Supreme Court, Justice, etc., said the following mm-hmm. relative to the issue that is right before the court at this time.
Well, one of the big issues, again, we mentioned a little bit about the president's pick for Supreme Court, and talking about precedent has become a pretty big buzzword these days mm-hmm. about that. And precedent doesn't always hold true. I mean, Brown versus Board of Education was overturned, Plessy versus Ferguson. So that was a law that was a precedent that was overturned. In the North Carolina Supreme Court, I would imagine it's pretty rare, though, to challenge precedent.
Well, it does depend. The Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court is still similar to the U.S. Supreme Court in the sense that stare decisis plays a key role. And what that means is, generally speaking, that a court is going to defer to its prior decision mm-hmm. and not overturn it. And the idea behind that is that one thing that the law absolutely requires is stability. You mm-hmm. can't have instability in the law, or else there's going to be chaos. But you know, there are certain situations where overturning a precedent is necessary, and stare decisis isn't an end all be all rule.
Mm-hmm.
Those are well accepted to be circumstances where, for example, the prior precedent is now unworkable,
mm-hmm.
And other situations where you might have had something like, you know, in Plessy versus Ferguson or even thinking about something like Dred Scott, where the decision was just so manifestly egregious.
Well, even just recently, the Wayfair decision actually overturned an earlier decision that mm-hmm. was really because technology had, mm-hmm. had changed.
Mm-hmm.
And so the law was not applicable anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes prior cases just become, you know, they kind of become
obsolete.
Obsolete is definitely the right term to use for that. So
yeah. Well, anyway, I'm fascinated by it. And we'll talk a little bit more with Cecil Harvell and Samuel Morris here in just a moment as we continue on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins. If you'd like to join us, 800-818-2255 or the local numbers.
247-7282 or 353-4674.
Welcome back here on Coastal Daybreak here on the Talk Station. Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins and Samuel Morris joining Harvell and Collins now. We're talking about the appellate system. You mentioned about, Samuel, about the 30-minute oral argument.
Mm-hmm.
How much does that oral argument play into a final decision? Or I would imagine all the research and all the things that the courts
right.
are doing are really play into it. But how much does that play into the result?
Right. Well, you know, it's funny because I think Justice Scalia once said that by the time the case gets to oral argument, pretty much everyone's made up their mind. You know, mm-hmm. oral argument doesn't change things a whole lot at the U.S. Supreme Court level. But at the state Supreme Court level, it's got a pretty big impact. I can't go into details about whether, you know, I know of situations where it swayed the justices one way or the other, but a bad oral argument can definitely doesn't help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it's one of those things where, the brief stage is so important. You know, that is where all of the research is displayed. All of the arguments are put forward in the most
all
cogent
the cards
manner.
Are played,
exactly.
On the table.
But at oral argument, you really start to see the justices show where they see the rub to be.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not able to address those issues, or if you address them in a way that goes way beyond what you need, if you overstate your case
mm-hmm.
or you perhaps say something that isn't accurate, that definitely doesn't help. So it's really important at that stage to be sure that you're able to answer all of the justices' questions in a way that's concise and to the point and addresses the concerns that they have. Because if you don't, it might show that it might indicate that you're not as prepared as you should have been, and it doesn't help.
We just recently had a case down in Emerald Isle of a property of
mm-hmm.
and that was being decided about beach access, et cetera.
Absolutely. I mean,
and that was very important around here. And that went to the Supreme Court, I believe.
It did. I believe it did not actually make it through to oral argument because
yeah.
I believe it was dismissed ex marimotu by the court, which meant on the court's own motion.
Mm-hmm.
That case brings up an interesting point on the issues for discretionary review because the court's docket is largely discretionary. And what that means is that they're going to generally hear cases where the case presents a very unique, important jurisprudential issue
mm-hmm.
that impacts a lot of people. You know, it's not going to be one of these isolated, oh, I just think that my case was wrongly decided kind of thing. It's got to touch more people than that. It's got to present kind of a statewide issue or an important jurisprudential issue where the law isn't clear on a point or something like that. And the petition for discretionary review is a long discussion in and of itself, perhaps best reserved mm-hmm. for another day. But nevertheless, those issues are very important.
In a case that comes to the state Supreme Court, does it have to directly apply to the state constitution?
It doesn't. North Carolina Supreme Court can interpret the federal constitution.
Mm-hmm.
It can involve just state statutes. And in fact, many of the cases that come before the court involve just interpreting state statutes, not North Carolina, not the state constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, though, while I was there, we've seen a pretty big uptick in the state constitution litigation. In particular with, you know, the governor suing the General
powers,
Assembly
yeah.
and
right.
all that kind of stuff. So it was an interesting time being there because you really got to see some of those bigger constitutional cases, which hadn't been decided yet.
If you want to find out more about settling your own case, you want to talk to the folks at Harvell & Collins, and you can find them online at harvellandcollins.com and give them a call at 252-726-9050 and 1107 Bridges Street in Moorhead City.